Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for July's Emergency Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce our speaker for today, veterinary surgeon specialising in emergency and critical care, Shailin Jasani. Thank you, Shailin. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Okay, thank you, and thanks everyone for joining us on this webinar entitled Ketamine, More Than Just a Horse Tranquilizer. So the title of the webinar basically stemmed from the fact that, I don't know about you, but for a long time, whenever I used to hear about ketamine on the news, they used to always introduce it as a horse tranquilizer. And of course, for a very long time, ketamine has been used for far more than just tranquilizing horses. And so for today's webinar, we're going to talk about ketamine in more detail and some of the uses of ketamine in small animal practice, not just emergency practice, of course, but I guess with a focus more on the emergency side of the patients that you're going to see. So I'm going to start with just some general information and general background introductory stuff about ketamine, and then go on and talk a little bit more about specific uses and some of the kind of controversies, if you like, with respect to ketamine. So one of the things to note, I guess, is that ketamine has actually been around for quite a long time, and this image here from 1965, which was from a fight between Muhammad Ali and Sonny Liston. This 1965 was when ketamine, the first reports of ketamine being used in medicine. And I found this reference from 1973 entitled The Use of Ketamine in Feline Anesthetic Practice, and this is from the Veterinary Record in 1973. So it's been a drug that's been around for quite some time. One of the things that we always have to bear in mind when you listen to any presentation, or indeed you read anything really, is that, you know, we have to increasingly pay as much attention as we can to evidence-based medicine. And if we look at ketamine in the context of evidence-based medicine, then certainly there are a number of publications in the peer-reviewed literature reporting the use of ketamine in dogs and cats. Of course, remember that when you're looking at evidence and deciding whether you should, you know, use that evidence in your clinical practice in some way, remember that one of the things that you have to pay attention to is, first of all, is this a species that I'm involved in dealing with? And second of all, it may be a species that you deal with, but also, is this the context under which I would be using this particular intervention or drug or whatever it might be? And so when you're looking at literature reports and so on discussing the use of ketamine in dogs and cats, we find that a lot of what's been published to date is very much in the kind of anesthetic sphere rather than, let's say, in conscious clinical patients. And so you kind of have to bear that a little bit in mind, is that a lot of the publications looking at ketamine do so in the context of animals that are under anesthesia. And the other thing is, you know, as always, bear in mind that there is a distinction between animals that are clinical patients that are presented to you for management because they have a clinical problem, versus animals that are being used in experimental settings and in which, excuse me, in which a, you know, particular problem has been introduced to an essentially healthy animal. And again, some of the implications of the differences there are in terms of, you know, what ketamine might do, for example, to the cardiovascular system or the respiratory system of a sick clinical patient versus a healthy, in inverted commas, experimental patient. So, you know, whenever you're looking at the use of anything, really, in terms of clinical practice, you kind of have to bear some of these evidence-based principles in mind in terms of saying, well, you know, which patients are being described here, and are these the sort of patients that I would be treating clinically? And, you know, looking at ketamine is no different to that. And, you know, to my knowledge, there's very little that's actually been published looking at ketamine use in actual clinical patients, and certainly not in a kind of prospective fashion. So a lot of the experience that we have to date is very much, you know, anecdotal, if you like, but it obviously has been used for a very, very long time by a very large number of clinicians, you know, managing dogs and cats, whether they be under anesthetic or indeed not under anesthetic. Of course, I can't really talk about ketamine without reminding you about this thing from the RCVS, which says that ketamine may be the subject of misuse and therefore should be stored in the controlled drugs cabinet and its use recorded in an informal register. And again, this is certainly not a reason to not be using ketamine. It's just something that you have to be cognizant of, you know, that we need to make sure that we keep it locked away. So in terms of how ketamine works, ketamine is an NMDA receptor antagonist, and the NMDA receptor is basically a receptor that's found very widely throughout the central nervous system. And so one of the kind of most widely recognized roles of ketamine is as an NMDA receptor antagonist. But it's worth bearing in mind that if you look into the literature in terms of, you know, what else does ketamine do pharmacologically, you will find that actually there's a whole lot, you know, written about all the other potential things that ketamine may do, which I guess is not surprising given, you know, we'll come on and talk about the kind of dose-dependent effects that ketamine has, and I guess it's not surprising that a drug that can have quite varying effects in the clinical patient is likely to work at potentially multiple receptor sites. So, you know, most people refer to it as an NMDA receptor antagonist, but it certainly can work in many other sites as well. And so ketamine has been described as the nightmare of pharmacologists just because it is quite a complex drug in terms of trying to summarize its potential mechanisms of action within living patients. So from a clinical point of view, in terms of what we use ketamine for and you know, what it does, basically it has these overlapping ranges where at the lower end of the dosing, you start off with analgesia, and then the more you give, you get sedative effects in your patient, then you get partial dissociation, and then you get full dissociation. Now, obviously, at the upper end of the spectrum here, so, you know, when you get to this point, kind of up here, you can keep giving more ketamine, but you're not going to get a more dissociated patient because you can't be more dissociated than dissociated, if that makes sense. So once the patient's fully dissociated, then giving more ketamine is not going to have a greater effect on the patient. But one of the things to bear in mind is, as I said on the bottom of the slide there, you know, there are overlapping dose ranges in terms of what response you're going to get from the patient. So whether it's more as analgesia, there starts to be some sedation and there starts to be some dissociation. And, you know, you can't really predict this specifically in an individual patient. And so whilst you may find some dose ranges being recommended in different resources, you know, there is overlap between these ranges. And you kind of need to bear that in mind when you're deciding, you know, your dosing in individual patients and what kind of response you might get. Certainly from the point of view of analgesia, you're going to be starting at the lower end of the dose ranges and then adjusting and titrating your dose upwards along with other analgesic agents that you might be using. And you know, you can find dose ranges for ketamine in all the sort of standard formularies and so on that you might use on a regular basis. Just bear in mind the caveat that there is overlapping ranges here. So, you know, one of the big things I think it's fair to say that has been had a lot more attention in recent times in human medicine and in veterinary patients has been the fact that ketamine is now, you know, well recognized as being a drug that has analgesic properties. And so its use as an analgesic agent is something that's been gaining increasing attention. Now, obviously, when we were using ketamine for sedation or anesthesia, it's not like the patient wasn't getting that analgesic benefit, because obviously they would have been. But we perhaps weren't really using it for that purpose or didn't really recognize that ketamine was also providing analgesia. And so certainly what's had a lot more attention in recent times has been the use of ketamine as an analgesic agent, or at least the recognition that when it is used for sedation or anesthesia, it is also providing some analgesia to the patient as well. In terms of the sites of analgesia, then, you know, these are both spinal and supraspinal, so in the spinal cord, but also in the brain as well. And then one thing I wanted to mention was this concept of sensitization or wind-up. So one of the things that the NMDA receptor has a lot of attention on is its role in sensitization. And sensitization is essentially the principle that if you allow a patient to be painful, the longer they go on being painful, there are chemical changes and neurochemical changes that occur in the body, which has certain consequences for the patient. And we basically say, okay, the patient is wound up now. And what that means is they basically become more sensitive to pain. So there are phenomena such as hyperalgesia, which is the idea that a stimulus will now have a greater effect on the patient. So let's say you prick the patient with a pin. Maybe before they're sensitized, you got a response of 5 out of 10. Once they're sensitized, you might get a response of 7 out of 10. So that's a very crude way of describing it, but that's essentially the concept of hyperalgesia, so a sort of exaggerated response to a stimulus. There's another concept is allodynia, which is basically the idea that a stimulus that before would not have been painful to the patient will now be painful if you've allowed them to become sensitized or if you've allowed wind-up to occur. And so with that in mind, then one of the touted effects of ketamine is as an anti-sensitization agent because of its role on the NMDA receptor as an antagonist. And so, you know, certainly ketamine has a role from the point of view of anti-sensitization, but as I said earlier, it also has quite complex biochemical effects. And so, you know, we would use it for analgesia without necessarily being able to say, well, there's this amount involved in anti-sensitization and so on. And in some respects, it doesn't really matter. But you may well find, you know, that people refer to it in that way as an agent that is involved in trying to prevent and potentially even reverse sensitization in patients that have, you know, that have had sensitization or are wound up. I mean, the key messages there really are just that you want to make sure that if your patient presents to you painful, that you do something to alleviate that pain as soon as you can. And depending on how long they have been painful for and so on, then again, introducing ketamine very early on might be useful from that point of view. And then the other thing is if you are going to cause pain in your patient, so let's say you have a patient that you're going to do a surgical procedure on, then before you do that procedure, you want to make sure that you give that patient some analgesia beforehand, and that way you hopefully try and stop sensitization from starting. And you know, this is part of the principle of using pre-medications before surgery, is that you're trying to involve or include an analgesic agent in that can help stop sensitization. And so certainly ketamine would be another, you know, would be an agent that you could well consider. But that sort of preemptive use of analgesics is not specific to ketamine in terms of preventing sensitization. Other points that are worth noting in terms of ketamine, one is, and again, you probably hear this a fair amount, is this concept that the reflexes are preserved in your patients. And again, some reflexes are going to be more or less relevant to us, but things like laryngeal reflexes and pharyngeal reflexes will be things that potentially will have more implications for us when we're looking at intubating patients and so on. The other thing is, in terms of metabolization and excretion, so what do you need to know, what do you need to worry about? I mean, in truth, there's not that much. So metabolism is hepatic in the dog, and there's minimal hepatic metabolism in cats. And in terms of excretion, then, you know, it's renal excretion of both the parent agent and the metabolites. Now, remember that whenever you hear something like that, the next question you should be thinking about, well, it kind of is, so what? And what does that mean from my clinical point of view? And there's a lot of agents, you know, that are metabolized by the liver and excreted by the kidney. And the question we always need to ask ourselves is, what implication does that have actually when I'm managing patients? And again, remember what I said earlier on in the webinar about, you know, evidence base and what do we really know? And you'll find that a number of recommendations that you find written in pharmacological and other kind of resources, a lot of it can be quite theoretical, but it's never really been demonstrated in real clinical patients in some kind of robust evidence-based way. So one of the questions we would ask ourselves when we're looking at an agent saying, well, okay, you need to be metabolized by the liver and you're going to be excreted by the kidney, is what does that mean for when I'm managing patients that might have impairment or insufficiency of either the liver or the kidney? Now, to my knowledge, there's no evidence base per se to answer this question in dogs and cats, and so again, it would be a theoretical response. But from what I can find in humans, then you know that what's been reported so far is that you don't need to adjust the dose for when you're treating patients that might have liver or kidney problems. So I guess for us at the moment, you know, again, it's difficult because we would just be extrapolating from human patients. But this whole area, in truth, about dose adjustments, not just for ketamine, but for any agent, really, there's very little that's actually known in clinical patients, and a lot of it is either theoretical or experimentally derived. The long and short of it is, you know, from my point of view, is I think you need to use the agent to achieve the clinical effect that you want to achieve. And, you know, I said earlier about overlapping dose ranges. In general, we tend to start kind of on the lower end of a range of what we're trying to achieve and then increase the dose as we need to. And ketamine is the kind of drug that you can titrate upwards anyway. And so, you know, if I was treating a patient, in general, I would be starting lower and going up if as I felt appropriate. And certainly if they had liver or kidney issues, if you like, I would probably, you know, employ that principle even more diligently and start lower and go up. But I certainly wouldn't let it stop me from giving the patient as much ketamine as I felt he or she needed in order to achieve the response I was trying to get. Okay, so let's move on and talk about the sort of clinical use of ketamine. And I thought to do that, I would use a kind of a sort of illustrative case, if you like. Now, this is not a specific cat. It's more of a kind of homogenized hybrid of what you might see in a patient. But I thought it might be nice to illustrate how we might potentially be able to use ketamine. Before I do that, let me remind you, of course, about the kind of general approach to emergency patients. So if you see a polytrauma cat, remember that, as always, we're going to start off by triaging the patient, which is basically our attempt to understand how severely affected the patient is and therefore what kind of interventions we have to do with what degree of urgency. And remember that with emergency patients, what you're really trying to do is to rule out serious problems and make the patient feel better. You don't have to make all the diagnoses, fix all the problems, etc. The first hurdles are really just to rule out serious problems and make the patient feel better. Now, what we do when we triage patients, we typically do some or all of a major body system exam, so cardiovascular, respiratory, and central neurological, and then pain assessment is something that's very much included in this initial intervention. And on the upshot of that, we're going to make some decisions about what do we have to do, and certainly giving analgesia is potentially going to be something that we're going to be doing very early on in a large number of emergency patients that we see. And kind of when we look at ketamine's involvement in these patients, then it is an agent that you might start to think about very early on in some emergency patients that you see. Now, I'm not going to go through the rest of this algorithm in detail because that's not really the purpose of this talk, but I couldn't leave it out because I think it's important to always flash it up and show people to remind you about the concepts of emergency medicine, triage, major body systems, and so on. So if we look at this particular cat that we're talking about here, when you do this, you find that this cat has moderate hypoperfusion or moderate hypovolemia, or if you like, this cat is moderately shocked. Cat's also obtunded, has evidence of head trauma, respiratory systems unremarkable, pelvic fractures are highly suspected. Again, remember that these sorts of cases, it's not really the time to start manipulating the pelvis and trying to confirm your suspicions. You can often get a sense that the pelvis is likely to be fractured just by the position in which the cat's lying, you know, asynchrony between the different hind limbs and so on. So I'm not suggesting you start manipulating the pelvis of a cat like this, hence I've put highly suspected. And the cat also has a hind limb degloving injury. So this is the kind of picture that you're seeing. You know, I'm sure many of you are very familiar with seeing these unfortunate cats that get hit by cars a lot, and certainly these types of injuries are very common. And as always with these cats that are in moderate to severe shock, then hypothermia is certainly something that we may well encounter as well. It's quite a common part of this kind of clinical picture of shocky cats. So some head trauma. Pelvic fractures and the hind limb degloving injury. And as I said, this is not a single cat. It's kind of a homogenized group, so you can see the fur on this leg is different to the other cat. So what are we going to do with a cat like this? Well, okay, so again, I would be remiss to not remind you about our first principles. So one of the things we're going to do very early on in a cat like this that's in shock is to provide some fluid therapy, intravenous fluid therapy for resuscitation. And so this picture is a picture of Hartmann, after whom Hartmann's was named. And I'm not going to talk about that in any more detail. As I said already, one of the other things we're going to think about very quickly is analgesia. And so certainly for a cat like this that's in shock, we'll be thinking very quickly about wanting to administer a pure opioid. Methadone is now a licensed agent in dogs and cats, and so we would certainly administer some methadone to this cat. And then in terms of this kind of hind limb degloving injury, then one of the things you could think about doing there, for example, if you remember your principles of kind of multimodal analgesia, is to say, well, I've given you some methadone, is there anything I could do for the wound itself? And so a case like this, you could, for example, soak some swabs in lidocaine that's been diluted down with saline, for example, wrap it around the wound, cover it with some cling film, and that's kind of part of trying to provide some multimodal analgesia to this cat. So very quickly after presentation, a cat like this is going to get some fluid resuscitation and have started some analgesia. You've got to protect the wound and ideally apply some topical local analgesic to that wound. One of the questions you need to ask yourself is, well, actually, could I add ketamine as part of this cat's multimodal analgesia? And if there's any reasons why you should or should not do that, could you not do that? Would it be a good idea or not? So one of the things that people might say about a cat like this, for example, is remember I said that this cat has evidence of traumatic brain injury, and so it's quite likely that this cat will have raised intracranial pressure. Now remember that you can't tell that for sure very easily in the majority of our patients, because we don't have such things as intracranial pressure monitors in regular use in veterinary patients. And, you know, certainly some of the signs that you might look for in cases that are suggestive of raised intracranial pressure, especially when you've got a cat that's in shock and is hypothermic and, you know, has other injuries, those sorts of things may not necessarily be that apparent, and to be honest, there aren't that many of them. And we're certainly not talking at the moment about a cat that has a Cushing response, for example. So we don't know, for example, that this sort of a cat will have raised intracranial pressure. If they've had a significant head injury, it's quite likely that they will. Now, one of the things you'll find written about ketamine in many, many resources over the years is that it's contraindicated for raised intracranial pressure. And so basically for a cat like this, we should not be using ketamine. But remember I said earlier that you shouldn't just read things and assume them to be true, and you've always got to ask yourself the question, well, you know, where did this information come from? And actually, if you started to delve into the evidence base for the fact that ketamine is contraindicated in raised intracranial pressure, you find that basically it's hugely debatable. So what basically happened was back in the 60s or 70s, there were some studies done in humans that demonstrated or that were said to demonstrate that ketamine might cause an increase in intracranial pressure. And you know, from that point onwards, it sort of became a bit of a dogmatic thing that just got reported in human medicine generation after generation. And as far as I can tell, veterinary resources basically just picked that up from human medicine and continue to report that in generation after generation. So the idea that ketamine is contraindicated in clinical dogs and cats, as far as I can tell, there is no evidence base for that. It's extrapolated from human medicine. But what you'll also find if you go and look into it is that actually in human medicine, it's one of those things that has very much become dispelled in the sense that, you know, they've started to do better, proper clinical studies, if you like, looking at the use of ketamine in head trauma patients and other causes of raised intracranial pressure. And at the moment, there's still some controversy and there's still some debate about it, but there are a large number of people that use ketamine in human patients with raised intracranial pressure on a very, very regular basis. And so this idea that it's contraindicated is becoming increasingly debunked. Now, because of the levels, the sophistication, if you like, in the evidence base in human patients, they wouldn't necessarily just lump everyone with raised intracranial pressure in together. So they would say, you know, is this because of trauma? Is this because of a tumor? Is this because of seizures? And try and make that decision about using ketamine in each of those patient populations separately. But the upshot of it is, as a general rule, there are an increasing number of people in human medicine who are quite happy to use ketamine on the basis of more and more evidence that's been emerging, and on the basis that the original contraindication seems to have had no proper evidence base to it. And then if you look at that in the context of veterinary patients, then, you know, we're basically saying, well, we extrapolated it from humans anyway, and now they're debunking in humans. You know, so I don't personally think that there's any justification to argue that ketamine is contraindicated in our patients with raised intracranial pressure at this moment in time, because I don't see how we have any evidence base for that. And certainly can be a very useful drug, for example, in a cat like this. And so my personal point of view is I would quite happily use ketamine in a cat like this, regardless of raised intracranial pressure or not, especially if I felt that, you know, that the benefits were significant. The other thing that you need to think about in a cat like this is, well, okay, this cat's in shock, and so is there any reason why I might not want to use ketamine in a cat in shock? And actually what we find is that ketamine is said to be sympathomimetic, which means that essentially it drives or it mimics a sympathetic nervous system. And again, there's some description about exactly how it does that. But if you remember that in a cat like this that's in shock, what happens when you go progressively into hypovolemic shock is that your sympathetic nervous system kicks in to try and compensate for you. And so you could argue that if you give ketamine to a patient like that, it's going to help further boost their sympathetic nervous system rather than, you know, reverse that situation. And so again, one of the uses of ketamine that's got increasing attention in human medicine has been, you know, or at least it's said that it would be quite safe to use ketamine in a human patient that was in shock, versus maybe other agents that you might be considering, because at a minimum it shouldn't harm their cardiovascular compensation, and it may also serve to actually enhance that. So again, if we look at a cat like this, again, very much bearing in mind that this is extrapolation from another species in the absence of evidence of our own, you know, and as I say, I would be honest enough to say I haven't trawled through all the anesthesia literature looking for experimental dogs or cats that have had ketamine under anesthesia, because I'm talking to you here about a conscious cat, not one under anesthetic. Then again, I would be quite happy to use ketamine in a cat like this based on what I know at the moment from a shock point of view, and not be overly worried that it's going to make that situation worse. So for both of these reasons, it could be something that would be quite appropriate in a cat like this. So if we remember this picture that I showed you earlier about the increasing effects, or the different effects of ketamine, is increase the dose. So I'm saying, okay, I think it would be fine to give a cat like this ketamine as part of the multimodal analgesia if you felt that you wanted to. And certainly, you know, if you had a great response from the opioid and you thought, okay, that's all I really need to do, then fine. But if you wanted to introduce multimodal analgesia early on, then by all means you could do. And there's some good arguments for why you might do that. If we then move on and talk about sedation, so remember I said that this cat's got a degloving limb injury on the hind limb, and we've wrapped it up with some lidocaine-soaked swab to keep it covered whilst we continue doing our initial resuscitation of the patient. Obviously, at some point, you're going to want to do something to this wound, but whether you would jump straight to anesthesia or do something under sedation first, again, remember that this cat presented with shock, it's got head injury, I certainly wouldn't be rushing to anesthetize this cat to focus on its wound until I was very comfortable that his or her major body systems were much more stable. But so one thing you could do to try and do something about this wound would be to sedate the cat in a safe way so that you can lavage the wound, you know, and dress it more appropriately. And so you can think about using ketamine in this sort of situation as well. Again, remember I'm saying that, you know, we think it's pretty safe for animals that are in shock. So, for example, combine ketamine with midazolam on top of the methadone that the cat's already got, and have the cat sedated in order to do something to the wound without actually fully anesthetizing the cat. I just put some Celuvisc there, and I have no vested interest in Celuvisc, just to remind you that when you're sedating a cat like this, make sure that you lubricate their eyes whilst they're under sedation. Now, one of the things that I must admit I've never done myself, and I don't know if anyone listening to this has any experience of, is the question of whether you can use ketamine as an epidural agent again. And I'm not saying that you would be rushing to do that in a cat like this per se, but given the pelvic fractures and the hind limb injury, I guess it's something that some people may consider. And obviously cats are, you know, potentially a different challenge to, let's say, a Great Dane or something like that. But I just really wanted to mention it and kind of put it on your radar that the use of ketamine as an epidural has, or as part of an epidural protocol, has been reported. Okay, so in a cat like this, you might look at ketamine and say, I want to just, you know, go multimodal on some analgesia and I want to use ketamine for that purpose. You may need to sedate the cat, and you can certainly include ketamine as part of the sedative protocol. And then, you know, for a cat like this, at some point, you're going to need to do something about these pelvic fractures. And, you know, again, I'm not the sort of person that's going to be rushing to radiograph this cat's pelvis until I feel the cat's much more stable. Now, if you're sedating the cat to do something to the hind limb wound and you want to take some pictures and the cat is compliant and you can do it quickly without wasting a lot of time and so on, then okay, by all means, go on. But at some point, you're going to obviously want to make sure that you confirm your suspicion of the pelvic fractures and decide what you need to do about that. And so you're going to be looking to anesthetize the cat. And again, you can, you know, again, increase the dose of ketamine further to get the kind of high end of the spectrum of effects that you might get. So overlapping ranges, depending on the individual patient, but as you give more, you go from analgesia, getting some more sedation, getting partial dissociation, and then getting full dissociation. How are you going to give the ketamine? Well, it's typically given IV or IM. And I guess one thing I would say is obviously this sort of cat that we're talking about here, the cat's in shock, and so cat's going to need an intravenous catheter straight away and start your fluid resuscitation, in which case you can give the ketamine intravenously. But certainly if you had a cat like this that had, for example, a pelvic fracture and a wound on the limb, but cardiovascularly was very stable and didn't have the head injury, you could certainly start off with using the intramuscular route for your first doses of agents, depending on what it is you were going to do and depending on the cat's compliance and so on. But I'm certainly a very big fan of intramuscular methadone, for example, as the first dose in a cat that is otherwise stable and might be very painful, rather than restraining the cat, causing him or her extra pain, and fighting potentially with him or her in order to put an IV catheter in when you don't feel they need fluid resuscitation in a hurry. So there are some patients where I think the use of ketamine or at least methadone and then some ketamine IM may be appropriate, and it's got to be made, you know, a decision on an individual patient basis. But I'm not typically giving that more than once before I'm placing an intravenous catheter and then using that route. And then there's a bunch of other routes that have been described. And again, you know, this is typically in humans and variably evidenced. And of course, you have to ask yourself the questions in terms of, does that mean we can extrapolate that to our patients? And also, when might we find these particular types of routes suitable for use? And, you know, there are descriptions of, for example, trying to, you know, spray ketamine sublingually in cats. The rectal route is a route that seems to get described for all kinds of agents. And again, you'd have to sort of sit and think about what sort of scenario might arise when you might actually need to give ketamine rectally. You know, so I just wanted to put it up there for information, but I'm certainly not suggesting that you sort of start thinking about it, unless it's kind of one of those rare situations where it seems to be the best route forward for you. One of the things that we of course need to mention, especially when we're focusing on conscious patients, is this kind of phenomenon of ketamine emergence, dysphoria, mania, hyperexcitability. And I think a lot of people, when they think about that, they think more specifically about cats. I guess what we need to say there is that, you know, you can have some patients that do seem to have some degree of marked emergence from when they've had ketamine. Now, there are different people that have anecdotal reports of what they try and do to minimize that. And certainly one argument is, you know, would you add in some other kind of sedative when the ketamine's wearing off? Potentially, would you want to give some more opioid, etc.? I think the bottom line is you have to kind of make that decision based on the individual patient as to how bad a problem you think they're having in terms of their emergence. But also, I would say that, you know, in the types of patients that I'm used to dealing with, which tend to be sick, very painful, multi-trauma, emergency, critical care type of patients, rather than the population that I'm not really talking about, which is young, healthy animals that are being anesthetized and have had ketamine as part of that protocol. I mean, I certainly have had very, you know, limited problems with ketamine emergence in the types of patients that I deal with. So I really don't think it's a big phenomenon in the types of patients that I'm involved in. You may have encountered it in recovering patients from anesthesia that are healthy and have just had some kind of procedure done. And in that context, you will need to think about what else would you want to do to that patient to try and dampen down the emergence response. And as I say, You could perhaps give them a whiff of an alpha-2 agonist, or you could give them some more opioid, or whatever it might be. And there's different people will have different approaches to that. But I certainly wouldn't let that, I wouldn't let it be a reason to not be using ketamine quite frequently. One thing I would say, though, is again, I'm always interested to hear if anyone's used ketamine on its own, because certainly my own experience and that of people that I've sort of spoken to is that in our species, we tend to not use it on its own, because I have seen animals go crazy, if you like, when they were given ketamine as a sole agent. And so my personal sort of approach to this and my personal experience is not to use it on its own, but I'm always open to hearing about people that have used it on its own. Well, it has had some reports of being used on its own in people, but I'm not convinced that we should be doing that, but I'm very happy to hear contrary views. What does that mean? It means that basically, if, for example, you were going to use ketamine for analgesia, then make sure that you're giving it with another agent that's also going to work quickly. So if you give a patient methadone and then some ketamine, the methadone should be working. That should be fine. If you're going to use it to sedate patients again, make sure you give it with another fast-acting agent, so ketamine with midazolam, for example. But don't, be careful about giving ketamine alongside an agent that may have a long onset of action, for example, like buprenorphine, because you may well find that for a while it is really just the ketamine that's affecting that patient. And, there may or may not be an issue. And as I say, I haven't done it many times myself. I didn't do it intentionally either. It was one of those things where the ketamine started working before anything else I had given. And really, I didn't like the kind of response I got from those patients. But I'm very open-minded about hearing different views or different experiences. So as I said, use as a sole agent has been reported in people, and especially children. Not recommended in adult humans, and I sort of said, well, not recommended in all veterinary patients. And obviously, as with any agent, really, the more you give, the increase of adverse effects and risks. And similarly, in this conversation about using it on its own, at a much smaller dose, like 0.1 mg per kg, this risk of giving it on its own and getting some hyperexcitable manic response from the patient is going to be much smaller. If you gave like 5 mg per kg on its own, you'd have an increased risk. So again, it's going to be dose dependent. I personally don't do it. And then I just wanted to mention some other things that you may have heard about in terms of the use of ketamine in clinical context, or indeed you may not have heard about, in which case hopefully you'll kind of give them some thought. I spent quite a bit of time talking about the reported contraindication of ketamine in the context of raised intracranial pressure. One of the other things you'll often find written in formularies and books and so on is that ketamine is contraindicated in patients that have raised intraocular pressure. And again, it's a sort of similar conversation to what I mentioned with the intracranial pressure. If you go and look at what is the evidence for this contraindication, you will find that you're sorely disappointed insofar as there isn't any. That again, I've come across, there's certainly none that I've seen in clinical dogs and cats. And so I take a very similar view to raised intraocular pressure as to what I said about the raised intracranial pressure, that if I have a patient that has potentially got raised intraocular pressure, but I feel that the potential pros of using ketamine as an analgesic or as part of a sedative protocol, or indeed for anesthesia, outweigh any theoretical, non-evidence-based, maybe even not explainable risks to do with intraocular pressure, I don't let that stop me from doing it, because again, I don't think that kind of makes any sense at the moment, because there is no evidence. It's just one of those things that has been handed down. And again, I always say to people, if you've got some brilliant evidence tucked up your sleeve of good quality in clinical patients and so on, by all means, please let me see it, because I'd love to know about it. Now, the other thing I definitely wanted to mention was the potential use of ketamine for cesarean sections. I'm not going to go in this webinar into a full-on discussion about the protocol around cesarean sections, because that's not really the focus of this webinar. But you will, I'm sure, be aware of the fact that there are kind of different camps or different schools of people. The people that worry so much about using drugs before they actually remove the puppies or kittens from the uterus, that the basically anesthetize the patient without analgesia and chop them open. And remember I said to you about sensitization before, so if you anesthetize a patient without any analgesia on board and you cut them open, you're potentially sensitizing that patient because they're having noxious stimulation without any analgesic on board. And then at the other end, if you like, of the spectrum, there are people that treat cesarean sections like they do any other laparotomy, and they give them a full pre-med and treat them in that way. And I must admit that I'm in the camp very much where I will make sure that the dam has some analgesia as part of her pre-medication and induction protocol, because I just don't like the idea of cutting open an animal that hasn't got any analgesia on board. And, you know, my own clinical experience is that we've had very successful cesarean sections with using that protocol. And so I'm not going to get into a longer debate about the pros and cons of this, and you may have your own views, and we can potentially argue about it till we're blue in the face in the absence of decent published clinical evidence. But I just wanted to kind of mention ketamine in this context, because when I was researching ketamine, you know, you find that it has been used for cesarean sections in people. And again, you know, with the caveat of extrapolating across species, you know, it is, as I said earlier, considered to be quite safe from the point of view of not suppressing the sympathetic nervous system, not causing cardiorespiratory depression. And if that's happening in the mum, then maybe it also is not going to cause it in the litter either. You know, so from what I can tell, there's quite a good rationale for saying, well, if you're worried about causing cardiorespiratory depression in the mum and the litter, then using ketamine as part of your protocol in the management of cesarean sections might be quite a good idea. And, you know, would allow you to use less of other drugs that might be more depressive, if you like. So given the quick onset of action of ketamine, you could give it to the dam alongside your opioid. Remember I said before, please don't give it on its own, or at least I don't. I would give it alongside an opioid as part of, or give the opioid, give the ketamine as part of a pre-med, or actually literally just at the point of induction. But you could also think about using ketamine throughout the surgical procedure to contribute to your anesthesia. And again, that would allow you to titrate down your gaseous anesthesia that but yet you might be using as well. It might also allow you to use a lot less of your induction agent if you are using one. And certainly some people will induce with ketamine and diazepam, for example, and not include propofol or alfaxolone. And again, as I said, I'm not really going to be able to talk about the sort of whole approach to C-sections in detail, but certainly from my point of view, using it both before and during surgery in a C-section, as far as I can tell at the moment, seems to be something that makes sense and, you know, is done in people. Another potential use of ketamine that you may have come across is in the treatment of status epilepticus. This is a human medicine thing. Efficacy and safety of ketamine in refractory status epilepticus in children. And there's one case report from 2006 for its use in a dog. I checked the literature last year, actually, and I haven't still come across anything in the interim period since I did a thorough search for this last year on status epilepticus in terms of using ketamine. But it's certainly something that you might come across being mentioned. And again, like with all these things, you know, you'll find some stuff that suggests that using ketamine maybe lowers the seizure threshold and maybe makes the patient more likely to seizure. And then you'll find other things saying, well, actually, that's not true, or that may be true, but once they're already in status epilepticus, then for mechanisms that maybe are not fully understood, you could use it to try and help control. The take-home message is you'll certainly find that there are people who, if they have a status epilepticus patient that is not responding to standard management for status epilepticus, will consider trying ketamine as well. I must admit, from what I know and the reading I've done, I would be in that camp if I felt I had to. But again, it's something, you know, if you come across it, just wanted to flag it for you. I don't really think we have a proper evidence base about it. Personally, I would use it if I got desperate enough. And you can see in this case report, this patient had refractory status epilepticus. So clearly they felt there was nothing to lose. But again, something to be on your radar. Another thing that ketamine is used for in human medicine is in the treatment of asthma and status asthmaticus, as it's called. in children. And again, in human medicine, there's a lot of debate about, you know, you can't say, well, we've done it in adults, so we should do it in children, or we've done it in children, so we should do it in adults, because yes, they're the same species, but they're a different age, and there's a lot of discussion about, you know, are children just small adults and this kind of thing. If you then say, well, okay, that's all very well and good, but what about cats? You know, because obviously we know that feline asthma is a phenomenon. Again, I've not really found any evidence base supporting the use of ketamine in the treatment of asthma in cats, and we have to be aware of the fact that feline asthma is not is not exactly the same disease and the same clinical syndrome as asthma in people. I've asked around, I've talked to people, no one I've come across has done this or, you know, tried using ketamine in asthmatic cats that are having a crisis, and I have not myself, typically because I've not had to, because when I've managed those cats, I've managed to get, you know, the sort of response I was looking for in a reasonable time frame using standard management for severe asthmatic crisis in cats. But something I would have on my radar, and I guess if I was kind of in that situation where it was like, well, this cat's really not responding to therapy, what other options do we have within the confines of what you're realistically able to provide the patient? Would I try it? I suppose so, but it would very much be with a good conversation with colleagues and the client, and you know, we don't really have any evidence that I'm aware of, and it's not the same disease as it is in people. So again, put it on your radar, something to have in the back of your mind, but don't please go off and start using ketamine in all asthmatic cats, because it's very much not what I'm saying that you should do. Okay, so just let's summarize some of the points that we've touched on in this webinar about ketamine and why it's so much more than just a horse tranquilizer. So, you know, it's a complex drug and there's definitely more to be unraveled. And as I said, it's definitely getting and has gotten an increasing amount of attention in human medicine and increasing use in all kinds of places, from pre-hospital recovery of trauma cases, psychiatric cases, all kinds of things, right through to ER, ICU, surgery, and so on. As I said before, you know, it's a pharmacologist's nightmare. It probably does a lot of things. At the least, it's considered to be an NMDA receptor antagonist, and NMDA receptor is found widely in the central nervous system, but it's probably also likely that it does a bunch of other things as well, and no doubt over time we'll find that there's more to be unraveled. I showed you the picture a few times of that arrow with the CNS continuum, where at the bottom end of the dosing you're looking at analgesia. And I said, remember that, you know, there are overlapping dose ranges here. So if I say, look, the analgesic dose range might be, let's say, 0.1 milligram per kilo up to 1 milligram per kilo, which is a decent range. If I was going to use ketamine and I was saying I just want to give for analgesia, I would pick a number in that range. I would probably start with 0.2 or 0.5, depending on the individual patient, maybe give some more. But you just need to bear in mind that some patients at, say, 1 mg per kg may have a little bit of evidence of sedation, others may not, etc. So the more you give, you go from analgesia alone to adding some sedation, and then partial dissociation and full dissociation, you'll find guidance in terms of what ranges might achieve what, but bear in mind it's an individual patient-based thing that you need to monitor. I've said for quite a long time actually that, you know, I don't personally use it as a sole agent. I had minimal but bad experience when I did do that, and I wasn't trying to do it on purpose anyway, but always happy to hear if people are. In humans, they suggest not to do it in adults, but it has been reported in children. Certainly older, and probably still now in older formularies and other and resources, books and so on, you'll find it written that ketamine is contraindicated in the presence of raised intracranial pressure and raised intraocular pressure. But we talked about the fact that if we look into sort of evidence base for this, you'll find that these are things that were typically extrapolated from human patients. And even then, when they've now sort of gone back to say, well, where did these things come from? You know, they've found that actually the evidence base was really not significant at all, and so there's a whole lot of debate and controversy and more studies being published all the time in human medicine, especially in the context of raised intracranial pressure. And I'm saying that given that we extrapolated the contraindication from human medicine in the first place, and then just continue to repeat it for the years that have gone on, that from my point of view, I think it's perfectly fine to be using it in patients with raised intracranial pressure or raised intraocular pressure. And that, it may be that as time goes forward, we might get some clinical evidence base that actually suggests that maybe we shouldn't be doing that. But, I'm not sure how we will because, the logistics of getting good quality clinical studies in veterinary patients is not that simple. But who knows? And I guess we'll watch this space. But certainly for the time being, I'm happy with us using ketamine in these patients. I talked about the fact that I would consider it in C-sections. I think it might be a nice thing to be doing that could be part of a multimodal approach that would reduce the doses that you would need to use of other agents that may potentially cause more cardiorespiratory depression. It has analgesic properties, which is great as well. It's likely to help preserve the cardiovascular system to some degree. Now, remember that once you anesthetize a patient and we move away from conscious patients, then in some ways we need to look at those patients as a separate entity because you will find studies describing, that drugs do this, that, or the other in patients under anesthesia. But they're not clinical patients that are awake, and so I think we just need to be a little bit careful there. But from what I can tell at the moment, I would be quite happy to use ketamine as part of my pre-med induction and ongoing as an infusion or one or two boluses as needed, depending on how long a C-section takes. And I think it's likely to be something that will be quite helpful and quite nice in that context. So really, in summary, I hope that over the course of the webinar, you can see that really ketamine, despite what the news broadcasters used to say, although I'm encouraged to see that they've kind of seemed to have stopped saying that in recent times, that it is so much more than just a horse tranquilizer. It's a drug that has, a variety of different effects in our clinical patients and a lot of different options that we can consider using it right through from initial presentation through to surgical procedures, analgesia in recovery, and so on. And just to say that if anyone's got any questions about any of the things that I've talked about, I don't in these kinds of webinars tend to go into a lot of sort of factual minutiae in terms of specific dose ranges and so on because, so they're widely available. But certainly if you want any more information from me, there's a lot of different ways that you can get in touch, and I'm more than happy to answer any questions. If you've got any feedback for me or know of any evidence that I might not be aware of, again, I'm very happy to hear that, and so feel free to get in touch. And then just before we end, there's just one question that came through during the webinar that I thought I would leave until now. And actually, it's a very good question because it's something that I probably should have mentioned anyway. And so the question says, is it contraindicated to use ketamine in cats with heart disease? And so that's a very good question. And again, let me preface my response by saying that to my knowledge, there's no evidence base per se. And so I can't cite you a paper or anything. I think it's very much a sort of discussion based on thinking it through. So is it contraindicated to use ketamine in cats with heart disease? So the concern there is that, remember I said that ketamine is considered to be sympathomimetic. And so if you've got a cat that's got heart disease and then you give them a drug that might stimulate the sympathetic nervous system, both as a result of what the effects of that are on the heart itself, but also, for example, because you might increase the afterload to the heart by causing vasoconstriction, the upshot of all of that is that giving ketamine to a cat like that might increase the burden on the heart. And if they've already got cardiomyopathy, if they've already got heart disease, then maybe that's not a good idea. Now, I guess I would revert and say, well, for starters, we know that there are a number of cats that have subclinical cardiomyopathy, but you won't know that when you're presented with the cat. And so if you said, well, there is a risk that if I give ketamine to a cat that has subclinical cardiomyopathy, that I might cause them to decompensate. Well, what are you going to do about that? You're either going to stop using it in cats completely, or you're going to try and screen every cat with an ultrasound insofar as that's sensitive enough before you give ketamine. But from a practical point of view, I don't see how you can start screening every cat before you give them ketamine. So, from my point of view, I would say that I think you just need to use ketamine in cats in general. You may find that once in a while you had a cat, you use ketamine as part of their therapy, and at some point in the next few days you found that you had a cat in heart failure. And I actually say that on the basis of a very small number of cases that I've seen as referral cases where they had ketamine. They were actually block cats that got ketamine as part of the sedative protocol, and then they seemed to go into heart failure, and the theory was maybe the ketamine had caused a subclinical cardiomyopathy to decompensate. But they went on and had management for their heart disease, and I think, at the end of the day, if you think about the sort of thing, the phenomenon that we always say, which is about risk-benefit assessment, I think you're not going to be able to answer that question in all cats. I think we don't have an evidence base that says that you shouldn't be doing it in terms of, well, if I say, well, has ketamine actually been used in the management of patients with known heart disease? Well, yes, it has been, because the risk is theoretical. There are some anecdotal examples of where it's been a problem, but statistically speaking, those are a very small percentage. And, as we talked about in this webinar, it is a drug that has a certain number of potential benefits. So, to my mind, the risk-benefit profile says if you don't know the cat already has cardiomyopathy, then of course you should use ketamine anyway. And if, it's very unlucky and that cat goes into heart failure, we won't be able to prove it was the ketamine, but you might suspect it. But that's just one of those things that you'll have to accept that's going to happen potentially one in 1,000 or 1,000,000 or whatever the number is, and we don't really know. And even if I had a cat that was already in, that I already knew had heart disease, if I felt that using ketamine as part of their management was something that I needed to do, then I certainly would do it with a view on the fact of the risk-benefit profile and what my options were. So that's a bit of a kind of rambly answer, because the bottom line is there isn't an absolute yes or no answer, but certainly I think risk-benefit at all times. Be aware of the potential risk, but don't exclude it, blanketly in all cats. And I think that's the only question that came through during the webinar. So again, if you have any further questions, do feel free to get in touch. Otherwise, that's it from me.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Shailen for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.